Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, here on heritageradionetwork.org. And now that hopefully everyone has had their fill of St. Patrick's Day celebrations and corned beef and cabbage and soda bread and all those things that we on this side of the pond consider so Irish, we're going to fill you in a little bit about what's really Irish and what's really worth celebrating over. And by that, I am talking about my guest today, and it is the inimitable Dorina Allen. Dorina, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back again.
Dorina is the well-known cookbook author, chef, and cooking teacher, cooking instructor of Ballymaloe Cooking School, and once again another visit here to the New York area. Ballymaloe Cooking School is in County Cork, Ireland. Correct.
That's right. Exactly.
More details. Right. More distinct location. Should they know? I had the honor of having her on the show a year ago. Those of you who heard that interview. She's back again because this is the 30th anniversary of the Ballymaloe Cooking School. And I thought, well, what better program to present on a culinary history show than an anniversary of a well-respected and long-standing cooking school. I think it's fabulous. Welcome, Dorina.
In an unlikely place when you consider, the image of Irish food for many people in America. So often people say, well, you know, how come this is such a well-known cooking school in Ireland of all places? And how come, what is it that brings people from all over the world? So it's unlikely, but there you are. We're celebrating 30 years now. In fact, we've lots of celebrations this year. Just before I came over on Wednesday, we celebrated my mother, Normertle Allen's 90th birthday. And she's the person, of course, who started Ballymaloe House originally. And we're also celebrating 50 years of Ballymaloe House, of the restaurant.
And that was the restaurant, right?
Yes, restaurant. A 50 and a 30.
Well, congratulations. That's a lot to celebrate. And the rest, that's what I wanted to give people an introduction to, because I think so many people, they maybe have heard of Ballymaloe, and they know it has something to do with cooking. So I want you to give us that 30-year history, but actually go back before that, because Myrtle Allen is your mother-in-law.
Exactly, yes.
And she started, talk about it's a farm. It's a beautiful farm. Talk about the farm.
Ballymaloe is in the middle of a 400-acre farm, actually, and then the cooking school is about 2 miles from there, and that's in the middle of a 100-acre organic farm as well. So we're very close to the sea. It's east of Cork City, right down in the south coast of Ireland. And, of course, it's wonderful to have either a hotel and an inn or a restaurant in the middle of a farm. Because with the cooking school, we can grow so much of our own produce. So the students literally can see how the food is produced from the farm to the fork. And it took me a long time, really, for the penny to drop that this was the ideal situation to do a cooking school in. But certainly now, the main reason why students literally come from all four corners of the earth is because they want to reconnect with how food is produced and where it comes from. So they can have the opportunity.
And the original idea for the restaurant, when Myrtle opened the restaurant, was more of a farmhouse cooking restaurant?
Exactly. Or? Well, basically, Ballymaloe is a great, big, beautiful, elegant country house. I mean, the oldest part of Ballymaloe is a 14th century Geraldine castle. So it is a lovely, big, old, rambling country house. So Myrtle, when her children had grown up a bit, they were at boarding school, and they, you know, she was rattling around in the house almost on her own until they came home on holidays. And she thought, well, look, I'd love to open a little restaurant in the house. You know, we can use the drawing room when people arrive and the dining room, but the guests can eat in the dining room. And it'll be like dining in a country house. And so she decided that she would write the menu every day, you know, as one would at that time, depending on what food, you know, what was growing in the kitchen garden, what fish came in from the lovely fresh fish came in from the boats in nearby harbour of Ballycotton, and what was in season, or what and what meat the local butcher had, and you know whether she had lovely big plump chicken or a goose or a turkey or something. And that sounds not in the least unusual nowadays, but it was completely extraordinary in 1964 to actually write the menu every day at a time when most restaurants, when they opened, the chef wrote the menu was the same 10 years later.
That's right.
But Martel just, she was a housewife. She didn't, you know, she wanted to, she didn't, had no training like, and didn't wear a big high hat like the real chef. So she just fed her, she gave her guests the same sort of food as she fed her family and her friends when they came to dinner. And I always remember my husband, because of course I came from hotel school, and hearing about this woman, this extraordinary woman who was, you know, cooking, doing this beautiful food from the farm down in Cork, and then became a member of the family by the simple expedient of marrying the boss's son. But I always remember my husband saying to me that you know, they heard some sort of talk about maybe opening a restaurant, and then he was at boarding school at the time, and suddenly a letter came to say that the restaurant was open, and they couldn't wait to get home because they thought they were going to have proper restaurant food, you know, when they got home. And they were disgusted to find that the mother was serving the guests the same food as she served them.
But mom's, I mean, cooking.
Yes, yeah, but of course it wasn't just any old mom's cooking, because they had a wonderful herd of purebred Jersey cows, so they had Myrtle made wonderful homemade ice cream for them and for the her guests from that. And the kitchen garden, 2-acre kitchen garden, was full of vegetables, herbs, fruit, berries, currants. They had their own pigs, so they had wonderful roast pork. They had their own beef. So the produce was so beautiful, but she just cooked the same food. But and that was really interesting too, because at that time there was a big difference between restaurant food and home food.
Yes.
I mean, there were dishes that were served in restaurants, but you wouldn't that they would never dream of serving. You know, doing, for example, Myrtle would serve carrageen moss, or she would serve rhubarb, or lovely fresh mackerel in Ballycotton. Well, now that was home food, or food you serve to your guests, but certainly not something you find in a restaurant. So and that really appealed to the food restaurant critics. And within 2 years, she had the top rating in the food guides in the British Isles.
Well, it's interesting because it's sort of like how I like to say with many of the projects and guests that I interview, that everything old is new again, because this is where the restaurant industry has gone. It's come full circle, and it's the whole farm to table movement is once again back in fashion.
Yeah.
Not that it was ever fashionable in those days.
Yes, but you know, it's funny, we were always rather amused by this, because this is how we always were, of course. So it's really nice now that there's a real term for it, the farm to fork, and all of the other things like foraging and so on that we've, you know, we always incorporated, and Myrtle did too, wild foods and forage foods and seaweeds and so on into the menu at Ballymaloe. And now, you know, the whole foraging thing, of course, has become enormously fashionable. And we've been at the cooking school, we've been doing foraging courses for nearly 20 years now. And
it's amazing.
It's
yeah.
Fun.
Well, so, and the two of you really have to be credited for, I think, putting the proper face of Irish cuisine on the map, or creating actually a face of Irish cuisine on the map of culinary styles, because, you know, Irish food, as you well know, always got a bad rap for, you know, for
well,
being heavy and not very tasty.
I would have thought for a while deservedly so, actually, but really now the whole image of Irish food, particularly over here, in no way reflects what's happening in Ireland. There's an incredible renaissance on the Irish food scene, and it's sort of like a nation growing up in a way. We've really grown enormously in confidence in Ireland in the last 20 or 25 years. I mean, when I was a child, for example, you know, the term local was almost a derogatory term. You know, I mean, if the local shop a little in the village sold, you know, some apples or currants or lovely eggs from a local farm, they would charge less for them because they would reckon that, you know, that because they were local, they would, and they would, you know, should be sold for less. And actually, it was really in Italy with Marcello Hazan that I had one of those eureka moments about this, because we had, I'd been longing to learn more about Italian food. You know, haven't things changed so much? But when was that? That was, I suppose, in the late 70s, I began to read about Italian food, and I used to get Gourmet magazine, and I remember finding a recipe for pasta and rolling it out forever and ever and hanging it up to dry in the front of the Aga. And then I was desperate to learn more, and as luck would have it, Jane Montong, who was the food editor, who was the editor of Gourmet magazine for years, came to stay at Ballymaloe, and she said, well, there's only one person to go to, and that's Marcello Hazan. So I wrote away, of course, with snail mail at that time, got the little brochure back, and I remember Marcello, I think, was probably the first person to do those courses that many people do nowadays, where you would have cooking classes, but also you'd have visits to the local markets and the cheesemakers and the winemakers and all of that. And it was £650. And I thought, oh my God, it's so expensive, but I'd love to go. And my husband took the last money we had out of the bank and just gave me a present of that course, because I'd been working very hard. We'd done a farm shop on the farm and all sorts of things. Went to Marcello, and everybody had spoken about, you know, how amazing Italian food was. And of course, it was delicious and lovely. But two things happened while I was there. One was that we went to visit the market in one of the lovely markets. And I noticed that a lot of this was actually, I think I'm getting two trips mixed up now. But anyway, this was in Venice. I remember there on the side of the Grand Canal. And there were lots, I could notice on a lot of the stalls that some, there might be two lots of tomatoes or two lots of peaches or something. One was always more expensive than the other. And the one that was more expensive always seemed to say Nostrana or Nostrale. And of course, if you speak some Italian, you'll know exactly what that means. But I had no idea. And I was trying to ask the stall holders who were, where is this amazing place called Nostrale or Nostrana that all the best things come from? And, you know, they get really impatient with tourists who are not buying. And they eventually, somebody answered me, and he said, it's not a place, it's a, I can't do an Italian accent, he said, it's local, it's from the lagoon. And I said, well, why is it more expensive if it's local? And he said, because it's local, it's fresh, it's in season. And, you know, that was like a real eureka moment. Suddenly I thought, well, of course they've got their priorities right.
Well, was this trip, do you think, also, you talk about the eureka moment,
yes,
was this sort of the deciding moment too for you to think about doing this on your own?
Absolutely. There was another very interesting thing that happened on that thing. When we went at the end that week, there was a big build-up to the farewell dinner in Cesenatico. I think that was Marcello Hazan's hometown. But the wonderful fish that we would have on this dinner. And indeed, we did have a delicious dinner. I still remember the restaurant was on stilts called Gambara, I think it was out over the beach. And we had wonderful fish and fresh everything. But suddenly I thought, well, you know, this fish is not any better than, and in fact, the fish we get in from the boats, lovely fresh in Ballycotton, is every bit as good, if not better than this. And I suddenly thought, well, the solution to my whole, we were wondering as the prices for our farm produce and horticultural products became less, we were wondering what on earth we should do. So I suddenly thought, well, the answer is right under my nose. We're living in the middle of a farm and gardens. We have acres of greenhouses. We have orchards. We're growing mushrooms and such, et cetera. So we have the produce. We're right beside the sea. We have this wonderful fresh fish, every bit as good as the Italians. And I also realized from the markets that our own produce from our own gardens and greenhouses was absolutely every bit as good, if not better. So that was an incredibly important moment for me, where suddenly I grew enormously in confidence and realized what we had at home under our own noses.
Well, so take me back 30 years. I mean, the restaurant was getting going.
And, oh, yes,
and,
it was.
And actually, your mother-in-law went to France for a while to work at a restaurant.
She opened a restaurant in Paris called La Ferme Hollandaise. When I started, the school is operating 30 years. It started in 1983. So basically, Ballymaloe was well established when I opened the cooking school. So, and I remember, which was in the middle of our organic farm, and I remember we were trying to decide what to call it, whether we call it Doreena Allen's Cooking School or Shanagarry Cooking School. And my parents-in-law said, you must call it the Ballymaloe Cooking School. And at that stage, of course, Ballymaloe had already established, you know, really at that point, almost a worldwide reputation for its simple, delicious food. And so
was that primarily because it was on their property, and then you were using the
Well, we were just 2 miles away, but I had been also doing some cooking classes with Martel originally in Ballymaloe.
Well, it was a built-in brand,
exactly, and they were very generously. Actually, it was a great act of faith in me in one way to say, "Well, look," because the name had already in many people's minds would have had a, there was a whole expectation around the name. And you know, and people sort of trusted that it would be real quality. So, but also it was a huge responsibility to actually deliver what people expected from that name. So, yes.
Well, what was interesting to me, you know, having interviewed you before, and of course knowing you from years past and at the Food Network, that the school is actually, you started the school with your brother.
That
was a surprise. I didn't realize that before.
Well, Rory, my brother Rory O'Connell, who he had been head chef at Ballymaloe and Ballymaloe House for many years, and then he sort of decided he wanted a break. So I said, look, why don't you and I start the cooking school together? So we did. And he worked with me at the cooking school for, I suppose, maybe 3 or 4 years, maybe 5 years in the beginning. And then he went on to, you know, to he worked at Le Manoir Quatre Saisons and with Nicola Dennis in London and so on. And but now, in recent years, he's also back at the school almost full time with me. And he's written, and he's at long last, about time too, he's written his first cookbook, which is called Master It. It's got amazing reviews, and it's been nominated for, shortlisted actually, for an Andrew Simon Award, which the first book. It took me about 11 books to actually be nominated for an Andrew Simon. My Forgotten Skills book actually won it, but so that's great. So it's wonderful to have Rory back at the school with me again, and of course we have 14 teachers altogether.
Well,
we have one teacher with every six students, so it's, as far as we know, it's the highest teacher-student ratio of any cooking school. A lot of cooking schools have 1 to 10 or 1 to 12 or 15 sometimes, but our courses are very full on. We tend to pack quite a lot into them, and our whole sort of philosophy has been to promise less and give more, so that when people come you know, also to charge enough to make sure we can do a really good job.
Yeah. Tell me how has the school changed in terms of, so in 1983, the types of foods that you teach, the types of cooking that you teach, from the, you know, the pure basics and the good quality ingredients, what are some of the major changes that you've observed?
Well, you know, let's go back to the 1980s when I started. At that stage, people were still saying, oh, a lot of people would say, oh, I don't eat garlic, you know, it doesn't agree with me, you know, that sort of thing. And so, I mean, literally coming from there. And then also that, you know, the introduction of chilies, and, you know, as it gradually went along.
And herbs, I would imagine.
Fresh
herbs.
Many
herbs, yeah.
Yes, well, Myrtle always had, fresh herbs were an absolutely integral part of Ballymaloe type of food, always fresh herbs. So we had, but of course, when I came to Ballymaloe, I had only really heard of parsley and thyme and chives and so on. You know, I mean, it was 10 years, I think, it was my first trip to Italy when I really tasted fresh basil for the first time, or what you would call basil. But the other wonderful thing that happened within a year or two of me starting the cooking school was I suddenly thought, guest chefs, I could ask people to come and teach at the school. I could ask my food heroes to come and teach at the school. So I remember some of the earliest people I had were like Claudia Roden and Marta Jeffrey. Somehow or other, I think through Gourmet Magazine, I managed to find Marta Jeffrey's phone number here in New York. And, you know, at that stage, again, things have changed so much, but the thought of ringing America even was so intimidating. So I remember the courage it took to pick up the phone to ring Marta. And at that stage, actually, I was terribly fortunate because Jane Monton, when she came to Ballymaloe, again, the editor of Gourmet Magazine, was so taken with the Ballymaloe and with the cooking school, the idea of this cooking school, which she thought was doing a really brilliant job in the most unlikely place in Ireland, that she sent over her food editor at that time, Zan Stewart, and a photographer, Ronnie Jakes. It was a Danish photographer who used to do a lot of photography and thing. And they didn't say they were going to write an article or anything, but of course they did a cover story on the school. Amazingly, the Ballymaloe Cookery School was the first school that gourmet ever wrote about. They used to write about cooking schools. Yeah. But anyway, as luck would have it, the cover story about the Ballymaloe Cookery School was on Gourmet in March 86, and that was when I picked up the phone and rang Marcella Hassan. That's when I picked up the phone and rang Marta Jaffrey, and of course she had just read the article, and I said, you know, I've got a little cooking school in Ireland, I love your books and admire what you're doing, and I just wonder whether I could ever tempt you to come and teach at in this little cooking school in Ireland. And she said to me, is it Ballymaloe? And I said, it is. So she said, I'd love to come. I remember getting off of the phone and doing the equivalent of punching the air nowadays.
The power of the press.
Excited,
right?
Yeah. But then, of course, since then, we have had the guest chefs at the Ballymaloe Cooking School read like a who's who of the food people from all over the world. I mean, you know, Jane Grigson came, of course, Marcella Hazan. I mean, Anne Willett, you know, on and on and on. Stephanie Alexander's been over, Maggie Bear. And so we've had Claudia Roden, we've had. It's been a joy for me to have had, and Yotam and Sam, the Yotalengi boys, and on and on and on, you know. So.
Well, we have a lot more to discuss about this cooking school and your wonderful career. But first, we're going to take a short break. So stay with us.
Today's music is by Pamela Royal on heritageradionetwork.org.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the heritageradionetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Hi, we're back on A Taste of the Past, and I am talking with Darina Allen from County Cork, Ireland, and the Ballymaloe Cooking School. And one of the reasons for our interview, not that I wouldn't interview her for anything, actually, is a new book has just come out, and it is called 30 Years at Ballymaloe, and it is a celebration of 30 years of a cooking school. That's really to be honored indeed, because, you know, cooking schools come and go, and some kind of get a little tired, but what I think is marvelous about your school and reading the progress through the book and having talked to you is how the school has just grown and changed with the times, and how you've just incorporated so many new, I don't want to say trendy things, but things that are trending, but, you know, and more international type exposures, and just, you know, growing things on the farm to meet the needs of the students. Right?
Well, that's true. Well, of course, also apart from the guest chefs that we've had, of course, I travel quite a bit as well. And I've always, you know, if you're interested in food, it doesn't matter where you go. You have lunch, you have dinner, pick up ideas, you know. And so I've always kept an eye on what's happening in the food world and indeed on the food trends as well. But, you know, I pick and choose the food trends. I don't follow them slavishly. The ones that really resonate with me, I then incorporate that. So, and we've gone on from doing originally just cooking classes to forgotten skills courses to gardening courses to, you know, how to cure a pig in a day, how to build a smoker and smoke your own food, how to, all the foraging and wild food courses, the seaweed, all of those. And actually, recently, I've been doing courses for young mothers for feeding babies and toddlers, which
is wonderful.
One of the things that I've... And, of course, we've become more and more involved in education of the local children in our area, in the local schools, teaching them how to grow and how to cook.
How to eat properly, basically.
How to eat, yes, yeah. Exactly. Because all over the world there's a challenge now with, because we're becoming more and more detached from how food is produced. So, you know, all of us, mothers and grandmothers and so on, we really need to make sure we don't let any more of our little dotes out of the house without teaching them how to cook and how to grow. And giving them life skills. So, it's not enough to have academic skills.
Well, that brings me to another question I wanted to ask you about the students. When you first started the school, you told a little intimidating story in the book, but we don't have to give away everything. But what was the average age of and the makeup of your first few students, and how many students did you first have?
Well, I think on the first course we had, I think it was 11 students or something like that, and then we went to sort of 13 or 15 and 18, and then within 10 years we were bursting at the seams in the original building, because the cooking school, as it still is in, started in farm buildings, and then we have all around the farmyard, we have converted a lot of those rest of the farm buildings into catering accommodation, lovely cottages where the students stay. But then it's, gradually over the years, the numbers have increased. Now we take 60 students, actually, and there's a huge mixture of nationalities on this course at the moment. We do everything from three-month certificate courses to days, weekends, weeks, etc. On this course, there are 9 nationalities. On the last course, there were 14 nationalities. So you can imagine our little village in Ireland becomes very cosmopolitan.
Right.
And we've had lots of romances, and also somebody came back recently with his girlfriend that he met at the school and proposed to her down by the pond in the garden, and she said yes.
Oh, that's exciting.
Fancy, wasn't that nice? So now, mostly the reason why they come from abroad and everything is because they can have this farm to fork experience. They can go out at the gardeners in the morning, they can learn how to sow seeds, they can literally learn, if they want to, how to milk a cow, and that sounds a bit extreme, but you'd be surprised how many people love to do that. And then they can separate the milk from the cream, bring it up. We make butter every day, we make yogurt, cheese. They can bring their cheeses home with them after they've, when they're going home, not into America or Australia, but sourdough breads and all sorts of things. So gradually what we're teaching now has evolved. And actually, this book, this 30 years at Ballymaloe, the recipes that are in this, and there are well over 100 recipes in it, these really reflect the sort of food that we're cooking at the school and at Ballymaloe, and of course in Ireland at the moment as well. So, the basic philosophy of Ballymaloe to use fresh food in season, locally produced, and a lot of food from the farm is our own farm is organic. So a lot of the food we use is organic.
Right.
And,
well, you mentioned that you do offer a certificate course. Now, people who take the certificate course, are they primarily Irish students? Because they want to go on and work in a restaurant,
obviously.
No,
they're literally from all over the world. I've just come back from India, actually. We've had several Indian students, but our first Indian student to open a restaurant has opened a restaurant in Mumbai, very successful. It's just been nominated for the best continental, restaurant in Mumbai, because, they love to do European food as well. So that we're very, very proud of our babies.
Yes.
They're all over the world, and many of them have, are very well known now, have done television series. And I think something like 26 past students at this stage have written, best-selling cookbooks, and at least 7 or 8 of those have television series with it. I mean, not just my daughter-in-law, Rachel, who, by the way, married my eldest son.
So the tradition goes on. Right.
But, people like Thomasina Myers and people like Stevie Parle, not only has he got a restaurant, but he writes in the British Telegraph every Saturday. So they're all over the place. So every time I travel, somebody pops up from behind a counter somewhere in, and I always can say a joke that I couldn't go away with my toy boy, because it doesn't matter where I am.
Somebody knows
jumps
you,
up and says, who's that? So, but we're so proud of our babies, as we call them, all over the world, our students who are really, you know, doing well. And of course, on the 12-week course, it's really full-on course. It's like gastro boot camp almost, but they have so much fun, but they work really hard. And at the end of 12 weeks, they have the skills to earn their living from their cooking. So that three-month course now is a real immersion in how food is produced and, you know, and all of that. And it means that they that course is now looked on as an investment. People actually sometimes borrow money, or they actually use redundancy money, even sometimes, to do that course. And then they can start a business, or they can start, go and work in a restaurant or a kitchen business or whatever, write about food. There's so many options if you if you can cook.
Right. And indeed, money well spent. And you, with the cooking school, well, of course, you didn't become an overnight sensation and star just at the cooking school, but something happened, I think, that really catapulted you, and that was a television show. Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
I've been really so fortunate to have had so many opportunities kind of landed into my lap almost. I think it was, this cooking school was operating about 2 years, and suddenly one day a letter came in the post, as they say, and it was from our Irish television station asking whether I would be interested in doing a pilot for a cooking series with my mother-in-law, Myrtle Allen. And
and this was when?
When was this now? Was this in the 90s?
I'm thinking it's around the 90s.
The early
90s.
Yes, I think so. I should know these things. Anyway, I sort of then, tossing it backwards and forwards, I'd never seen a television camera, by the way, when I got that letter in real life. So I was kind of thinking, well, I won't. Oh, no, I can't possibly do that. I'll make such a fool of myself. Oh, well, then I thought, oh, well, if I don't, you know, I'll be living with, well, what if? So I thought it would be better to live with, you know, well, even if I had done it and it wasn't a big success, it would be better than living with, well, I wish I'd done it. So I had a go, and actually I decided that, you know, my food is very simple, and I just, the whole message is start off with really good ingredients, cook it simply so it tastes delicious. And it actually just went into orbit. So, and then I was asked to do cookbooks with that, and that, you know, I kept it simple and delicious, and the first cookbook made Irish publishing history. Was made by a cookbook. That was when I had brown hair and red glasses, though.
Oh, well. The red glasses are back, I will tell people.
And I did, like, I think 9 or 11 series of those.
I'm thinking it was before 1988, maybe?
Well, it could well be. I'm sorry. Dates are not my big thing. So, so that was, and then one book sort of followed another and so on. So,
And the rest is history, as we can say here on Taste of the Past. Yeah. You did have, the series was called Simply Delicious?
Was called Simply Delicious, we did a year at Ballymaloe, and there were various other ones as well, so yeah.
Now, who knew farm food was going to become, such a hit? What I wanted to have you relate to our listeners, because it is something that does happen, but people don't realize what impact it can have. And that is sometimes, and people beware when you read, especially on the internet these days, recipes that there can be mistakes.
Indeed. I have quite a story about this one. Actually, this was connected as well to the first Simply Delicious television program and the book that went with it. The book astonished, the book sales absolutely astonished me, but the publishers, and in fact the television channel, because it just literally, they couldn't keep them, you know, as they said in Ireland, it's sold in telephone numbers. And so my publisher then suddenly realised, well, my goodness, there's something going on here. So literally within a couple of months of that first book being published, he said, look, we should, this was about June or midway through June, he said, look, I think we should do a book for Christmas. We should do Simply Delicious Christmas. So I said, right. And so again, I started to gather up the recipes, got them into the editor, and I wanted to put both my mother's plum pudding and my mother-in-law's plum pudding into, which is traditional dessert in Ireland, or sweet for Christmas Day, into the book. And so Myrtle had already published the Ballymaloe cookbook, which is just this year being reissued to celebrate 50 years of Ballymaloe, with Gilla Macmillan. And I gave them my own mother's recipe, which is fine. Gilla Macmillan said, well, look, we'll convert the measurements, because in my Christmas book, I do imperial and also metric, and of course American measurements. So they, little junior in the office, got this recipe, looked and saw a 2-pound loaf of bread to make breadcrumbs. And of course, she was young and didn't realize that how we used to make breadcrumbs years ago was you'd buy a loaf of bread, let it get stale, you'd cut off the crust, and then you'd make crumbs on an ordinary box grater with the center. So she converted 2 pounds of breadcrumbs and put it into the and that the conversions were done, went straight into the book because they were in such a hurry to go to print. And literally within 3 or 4 days of the book being on the shelves, the phone started to ring and people said, you know, there's something wrong with this recipe. It says it makes three and I've got 5 plump puddings, the breadcrumbs everywhere. And I suddenly looked and I realised what had happened. And my heart, oh, that awful sinking feeling when you can see the page, the print won't change on the page, it's a mistake and that's it. And so I rang up my publisher.
So it wasn't 2 pounds of breadcrumbs, it was breadcrumbs from a 2 pound loaf.
Yes, right. But she was young and didn't realise right. That's what it was. So it was, and the breadcrumbs from a 2 pound loaf would be about 7.5 or 8 ounces as opposed to 2 pounds.
Big
it was
difference.
A phenomenal difference. So I rang my publishers and they said, look, you can tell people it's a publisher's error. And I said, no, we can't just do that because I've got to go on the radio and on television to tell people there's a mistake in the book because people by this stage, even after just one television series, absolutely trusted my recipes implicitly because I was so meticulous and still am about testing recipes. And we tested and tested. And I wanted people when they, you know, when they got up from watching the television program, people would say to me, I wanted to rush into the kitchen and make it. And then I wanted it to turn out perfectly for them. So I felt a big responsibility. So anyway, Michael Gill, lovely Michael Gill from Gill Macmillan, agreed. I went on the Gay Barnes chat show, which was the most listened to chat show in Ireland, and told the Irish nation about the mistake in the plum pudding. And the, you know, the Sun, the tabloid newspapers had cartoons about breadcrumbs coming out of everything and so on. And people, they say there's no such thing as bad publicity because the bookshop said that then even though there was no television series with it at that stage, although I did do a television series the following year to go with it, they said people poured into the shops, the bookshops, and said, could we have Doreen Allen's new book with the mistake in it? They didn't even know what the name was. And then I ended up by, you know, sending plum puddings all over the country that Christmas because people would ring me up and say, oh, we made our plum puddings, you know, the plum pudding, breadcrumbs everywhere. And I think many were genuine, but I think a few people got a plum pudding that never stirred the plum pudding. But nonetheless, so there we are. It's a salutary tale, but it caused great amusement in Ireland. I have to say, there were jokes on all the radio programs and newspapers and everything about the breadcrumbs coming out of the plum pudding everywhere. So.
Well, it turned out to be a wonderful marketing tool because, as you said, people trusted you, and now and they go back to your recipes.
I couldn't bear not to put in a correction because I didn't want to spoil people's Christmases. And you know, in the end, food writer, for the most important thing for us as food writers is to build up a bond of trust with our readers. And I feel quite strongly about this, actually, that many food writers, I think it's fair to say, don't take this responsibility seriously enough. So it's particularly serious for, you know, beginners because they cling to a recipe and then they'll say, oh, I can't cook, you know. But oftentimes the blinking recipe didn't work properly in the first place. So
that's
I
right.
just do think it is very important for us as food writers to really understand the responsibility we
have. And you have a cooking school at stake as well.
That's right. Oh, yes. Well, of course, this is the other great thing about the cooking school is that if there's anything, a recipe that needs to be tweaked, you'll discover the following day, basically, because and also when if suddenly a couple of students are making for doing the same kind of mistake, in inverted commas, there's no such thing as a mistake, really. It's an opportunity to learn, I suppose. But if several people do the same thing, I immediately, you know, I don't think, well, why did you do that? I say, why did this happen? And I go back to the recipe. And usually it's because I haven't been quite specific enough mm-hmm. in the method. So, of course, it's a great advantage to have the cooking school in that way. So to keep tweaking the recipes.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's wonderful. I think recipes are coming back more, you know, they started out with very elaborate head notes and explanations. And Julia Child-Korff was very good at
incredibly
explaining how
detailed,
things
yes.
should look at each stage.
Yes.
Then all of a sudden, then they got pared down to nothing.
Yes.
And as you say, people weren't sure what they were doing right or wrong. So I think now we're back to a trend of writing them more
not
fully.
Not assuming knowledge.
Right.
I mean, particularly for beginners, you know, you have to assume less rather than more knowledge.
Exactly.
It's not fair to them otherwise.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay, so there are lots of wonderful recipes in here and a lot of international dishes, I must say, as well, in the book.
Well, it reflects, the as I said, the kind of food that we're cooking at the cooking school and the kind of food that you can have in Ireland now. If you come to Ireland, you know, the food scene in Ireland is so exciting and so
That's
on.
That's what I say. It says, you look at this book and you say, well, this is not what I expect. This is not what I expect is Irish food. Well, you can't say there are just Irish recipes in here because
exactly.
They're international and they're all
that's right.
Equally
yeah.
delicious.
And if people are coming to Ireland, if they look at www.ireland.com if they want to get information about Ireland, and if they're coming anywhere near us, they're often in cooking classes at the cooking school every day, and cookingisfun.ie, if you look that up, you can see exactly what we're cooking on any day.
How many students in a, let's say, a one-year period of time rotate through the school?
We have, I suppose, thousands, really. But we take 60 students at a time, and that sounds like a lot. But that is just, in fact, everybody is demonstrated to together, and then they divide into four kitchens. And
you have one per
teacher
six.
With every six students. So there's really... that's an incredible help to people when they're learning. But one of the most exciting things we've now been doing, it's a more recent thing, is that we do a literary festival of food and wine every year as well. We started last year, an inaugural one, and we were hoping for 2,500 to 3,000 people. We had over 8,000 people. It was written up by the New York Times.
So these are cookbook authors and recipe developers and historians,
but
people who come and present.
An incredible lineup of speakers from literally top. And it's just, we decided not to go really for the celebrity chefs, but more for the scholarly, iconic food writers who write beautiful prose as well as cook beautifully. Like Marta Jaffrey, Claudia Roden, Alice Waters, Stephanie Alexander, David Thompson, Sandra Katz, etc. So this year, Rennie Redzepi is coming from Noma, and the Ottolenghi boys are coming, and so on. So it's that this year it's from the 16th to the 18th of May. So if anybody's in Ireland at that time, you know, we want to make it the Sundance of food and wine.
It sounds like you're on your way. You do have some pictures of last year's fest in the book, which I remember you telling me about it, and it was so great to see the pictures then of what was going on. And everybody, David Thompson, and giving everything from farm cooking to Thai cooking. I mean,
yes.
It was just...
And David Tanis, actually.
He writes in the New York Times,
yes,
right?
Coming, he's coming back again this year as well.
Great.
And I just love David's food. It's so lovely.
He was a chef at Chez Panisse for,
that's right.
for a
Indeed
long
he was.
Time.
Yes. Yeah. And by the way, Diana Kennedy is coming this year. Diana Kennedy, the doyenne of Mexican cooking. I mean, how amazing is she? Another 90-year-old.
Bless her soul, indeed. Well, what an opportunity for people, not only to visit the Ballymaloe Cooking School, but then to get a chance to hear all these wonderful food writers and cookbook authors and learn from their experience as well. Cooking demonstrations also along with that, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And also food history, again, of course, and budding food writers, things, a farmer's market. It's a huge fringe event as well. About growing foraging as well. Alice Fowler is coming again this year to do some foraging, and she'll be doing that with Rennie Redzepi from Noman Copenhagen.
Well, it sounds like an experience not to miss. So, Darina, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, and congratulations on not only the book, but congratulations on 30 years of cooking instruction at Ballymaloe. That is admirable. And, of course, all your success in your books, and I wish you more, because we have to come back next year, so you have to write another book. Right? You don't have to write a book to come back. You can come back anytime. Thank you so much, Darina Allen.
Thank you so much, Linda, for having me on.
This has been A Taste of the Past. And I'm your host, Linda Palacio. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.